everybody. My name's Sandy. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Sandy.
Happy to be here. Thank you, Jerry, for inviting me tonight to tell my story at your meeting. I appreciate it. Jerry and I are good friends, and I'm kind of bummed that I don't get to see him tonight, but I am glad that I'm here. My name is Sandy. I'm an alcoholic, and my sobriety date is August the 8th, 2003. So I wanted to start off tonight. I always like to try to start off with something to kind of pull me into the room. So what I'm going to read tonight is the long version of the Serenity Prayer. And, you know, most of us think there's just a few verses, but there's a long version. So anyway, I'm going to read that with my readers because that's what I need now. Okay, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardship as the pathway to peace, taking as he did this sinful world as it is, not as I would have it, trusting that he will make all things right if I surrender to his will, that I may be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with him forever. And I really like that prayer. And so I'm going to tell you in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So here I go. I was born January 8th, 1965, in Atlanta, Georgia. My parents were very young. They had me very young. I did not have a whole lot of parenting. I realized when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that that was not my parents' fault that I was an alcoholic. They did the best they could with what they had. But I pretty much raised myself. And it wasn't a bad life. I mean, I was always taken care of, always had food and clothing and all that, but I didn't have a lot of guidance, and I didn't have a lot of leadership, and I didn't have, you know, my joke is I didn't have anybody to make me a sandwich and help me with my homework when I got home. And once again, I love to blame that on the reason that I was an alcoholic until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and said that out loud in a meeting, and someone quickly corrected me on that. So, life was pretty good, and when I was 18 and got out of high school, I immediately went into bartending. You know, I mean, what else would I do? And I was very good at it. I always excelled at everything that I did, and I quickly became the person who trained people, the person who was in charge. I've always been a go-getter, even in, you know, my alcoholic times. And I got one DUI when I was 18 years old, and back then they didn't do much to you. I'm sharing my age a little bit, but I think I got like a $300 fine and a year's probation. And I think now it's a little bit more than that. So, and I'm amazed that I only got one DUI because my alcoholism took me to a point where I drank and drove every single night of my life. I was a bartender, you know, and what you do in the bartending culture is you get off work and you go to the next bar and you drink all night and spend all your money and give it to the next bartender, and then you somehow make your way home and get up and repeat and rinse that for 25 years for me. So I guess, you know, I don't like to talk a lot about the drinking, but we'll just say I'm here on a rainy Friday night, so I'm definitely an alcoholic. And I'll qualify myself by a few things that happened over my drinking. The first big thing that happened was my DUI, but I just thought, well, that's just bad luck. You know, I was over on Stewart Avenue at the wrong time. I think it's called Metropolitan Parkway now, but at the time it was Stewart Avenue. And I was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and it was the cops' fault and whatever and all that. So I continued to drink, and I continued to, you know, move forward in my bartending career. And I, like I said, I was always very successful. But I could never stay anywhere, so I moved around a lot with jobs. And as I got older and my drinking got worse, there were a few incidences that are, you know, a little embarrassing, but I used to hang out with a big crew of girls, and we used to go, you know, up into Buckhead, back when Buckhead was the place to go party. And one night I had a blackout, and I punched a girlfriend of mine in the eye, and she was no longer my friend anymore. And of course, that was her fault. I couldn't remember what she had done, but it had to have been her fault. And that was a pretty bad consequence. And later on in my drinking, I had bought a new car, and this was about 5 years before I stopped drinking. So I'd bought a truck and I really liked it. It was the first nice truck I had ever bought, and I had no business driving at that point. But one night I got up in the middle of the night, and I was living with a companion at that time, and my car was gone. Looked out the window, where's the Tahoe? The Tahoe's gone. Well, I pretty much knew that I had not paid the car payment on the Tahoe in quite some time, and they came and got the Tahoe. And the person that I was with at the time, he's like, oh, we need to call the cops. We need to, you know, and I was too ashamed to tell him the truth of, you know, what had happened. But the truth being, I was very, very grateful that that I didn't have a car anymore, because I really didn't have any business driving. And that was really when my alcoholism accelerated. And that person that I was living with at the time was a great enabler, and also I abused this person really, really badly. He had his faults of his own, but my alcoholism had accelerated to a rate that I was no longer in control, and I was a very angry drunk. You know how you change from being the fun drunk that everybody likes, and then you become like the kind of annoying drunk that people are like, and then you become like the drunk that doesn't get invited to the parties anymore because you're really obnoxious. And then you become the drunk that kind of drinks along by themselves. And that was pretty much, you know, I didn't have any car to go anywhere anymore. I was riding the bus, and I had gotten out of the bar business, and I was in the plant business. I worked for Lowe's right over on Peachtree Industrial the last few years of my drinking. And the joke, which is funny now, but it wasn't too funny at the time, was that I was certified to drive all the forklifts there in Lowe's. I worked in the garden center. And the 3 years that I was there, I probably never drove a forklift sober ever in my entire life. And the joke is that, you know how when you go into Home Depot or Lowe's, they close off the aisles when they have the forklifts in there to get something from down? Well, I was on one of those forklifts, so be glad that they marked those aisles off so you can't go down them. And it's just by the grace of God that I didn't hurt anybody, you know, or myself. So one particular night, and this would be what I call my bottom, one particular night I had been drinking pretty heavily at work because since I couldn't drive anymore, my backpack was my companion. My drink of choice was Grand Marnier. And even at the end, when I couldn't really even afford it, I liked to drink the good stuff. And so I would take a small bottle of it to work, and I would also take, you know, you had to have gum, and sometimes I would have smokable alcohol with me, and on my lunch breaks I'd have a little smokable alcohol with my drinkable alcohol, so then you had to have perfume as well to kind of mask that up. And then I would, you know, and sometimes I would go across the street to the Mexican restaurant and have a few margaritas and come back and get on the forklift and finish my day of work. Well, one particular night I got off work, and we went to, at the time it was called Jocks and Jill's, but I think it's Hudson Grill up in Brookhaven now, and that was where I lived. And went there and drank more. And I was drinking with a girl at work, and she was like, wow, you know, you've only had a couple of beers, but you seem really hammered, you know? And the truth was I had probably polished off about probably at least a pint of Grand Marnier. You know, what I would do is, and it sucked because the garden center was, excuse me, it stunk because the garden center was on this side of Lowe's, and the bathrooms were on the opposite side of Lowe's. So I would have to take my little breaks, get my backpack, walk all the way across, go to the bathroom, take a couple of swigs, you know, put some gum or candy in my mouth, come back, and then work outside in the heat for 8 hours. So it wasn't the best. Bartending was much better for the alcoholic drinking, but the reason I quit the bartending is because it wasn't me, it was the job. So I don't know if you guys have ever left a job because you thought it was the atmosphere that was making you drink too much, not really the problem of alcoholism. And to be honest with you, many years before I quit drinking, I knew that I was an alcoholic. So this particular night, I drank a lot more, and I went home, and I was expecting something when I got home, and that was not well received, because by the time, the end of my drinking, I wasn't bathing very much, I wasn't showering very much, I wasn't putting any makeup on, and I pretty much threw my clothes over in the corner and got up in the morning and just picked them up and put them back on. So there wasn't a whole lot of hygiene going on in my life at that time. you know, it's nice to be able to take a bath on a regular basis now, and occasionally I haven't put some makeup on like tonight. So anyway, I went home that night, and when my demands weren't met, I pitched a fit. And I pitched a fit in the way that I injured this person. I was physically abusive to this person. I had always been physically abusive to this person, as well as emotionally abusive, and you know, you name it. I was abusive to him in every way. I would demean him. I would talk down to him. I was just not a kind person to him. And he got to the point that night where he had had enough. So the police were called, and I did what every good alcoholic does. I took my bottle, and I got dressed because I knew I was going to go to jail. And I went in the closet and drank until the cops got there. And I was told that that's not like what normal drinkers do. You know, normal drinkers have a drink, and they probably have it in the living room or the kitchen, not hiding in a closet waiting for the cops to come. So that was a clue. Anyway, so I went into the closet and drank until the cops got there. And the boyfriend at the time really did not want me to go to jail. He really just wanted them to calm me down. And you know, this is recording me, I'm sorry. I thought it was a phone. So when they got there, unbeknownst to me until that moment, if the police are called to domestic dispute in the state of Georgia, somebody goes to jail, and it's usually the intoxicated person, not the sober person who was woken up out of a sleep into a raging alcoholic. So, and he really tried to convince them, don't take her, you know, I just want her to calm down, and they weren't having that. So off I went, and I was pretty much in a blackout, but I had a few little moments of clarity, and I must have been really raging in the car, the police car on the way there, because I felt like the guy was driving like a million miles an hour, and we went over to Memorial Drive. And I got to put the orange jumpsuit on and get my picture taken, and it was so cute, and I looked so adorable, let me tell you. I was about 30 pounds heavier than I am now. I was really bloated, really puffy. I just didn't look well. I looked sick. I don't know, there's something about, I don't know, I mean, I know alcohol does a number on everybody, but I mean, it really makes women ugly, you know? And I just looked horrible. And unfortunately, there's a little caveat to that. There's these little websites out now called mugshots.com and, you know, youreabadguy.com and look at this idiotic picture of you.com. And, you know, that is still floating around on the internet, unfortunately. So whenever I have like any kind of crazy thought, and I do not have any desire to drink, but sometimes I act crazy, and sometimes I just go look at it to go, yeah, you can go right back to that if you want to. You can go put the orange jumpsuit on and sit in the cell if you want to. That'll be fun, Sandy. So the answer to that is always no. So I was charged with simple battery that evening, and a very pivotal thing happened to me, and I didn't see it until I got sober, but while I was in that room, of course, you know, when you're drunk and you're hot and you're sweaty and you don't want anything, you're just raging and everything, and you're in this little room and there's just you and this one other girl, and I gave her my apple and I gave her my blanket, and you know, the next morning they came in with a sandwich. Well, it's not even a sandwich. You get like a piece of bologna and two pieces of bread and a packet of mustard and a packet of mayonnaise. They don't even make a sandwich for you, you know. So I gave her all this stuff, and she was this little girl, and she looked like she weighed about 80 pounds, and she was in for solicitation of drugs, which means she was doing what she needed to do to get what she needed to get. And we were in the same cell for quite a while, and then they separated us, and they went to go put us in what they called the pods, which is in with the general public, and the general population, I should say. And they separated us, and I didn't see her for about 6 or 7 hours. And then the next morning, we went before the same judge. And I'm sitting in seats kind of like this in the courtroom, and she looks over at me. Now, see, I thought she was worse than me because she was a drug addict. You know, I'm just drank too much that night and lost my temper, you know. So she looks over at me, and I'll never forget this moment. And she said, I don't know what you drank last night, but you stink. And this was like 12 hours later. So I was pretty, it was not good. It was not good at all. And that was the moment of clarity for me. That was the moment when I realized, A, that I'm no better or worse than anybody with any type of addiction, whatever it is, and it leveled the playing field for me. But it also was a beautiful thing because I had a moment where I knew that I didn't want to live like that anymore. I didn't want to be mean to people. I didn't want to hurt people. I wanted a better life for myself. And there's a lot of other things in my history that I don't really share from the podium, but what we'll say is that alcohol took me to some bad places, took me down some really dark paths, took me to some ugly places with some ugly people doing ugly things. And, you know, I look back on that and I realize that it wasn't me, it was the alcohol. Yes, I was doing it, but I haven't done any of those things since I've been sober. And so I had to learn how to forgive myself for some of those things and realize that I was sick. You know, I was very sick with my alcoholism. So that night when I was in jail, I had to call my mother for the first time and get her to bail me out. I was one of those people that didn't, you know, it talks in our book about how we become either too dependent upon people in our lives or we try to control and dominate everybody in our lives. And that was me. And the best way for me to deal with my family was to pretty much omit myself from them. So I didn't call them for them to bail me out of jail. I didn't call them very much to help me, but I omitted them. I moved to this side of town. They live on the south side. I had really distanced myself because, you know, there's something about your mom. She can look at you and know that something's not right, you know? And I always, she always says to me, which I can't believe they didn't know I was an alcoholic, but they always say to me, we always knew it was something, but we didn't know what it was. And that was the way I wanted it. So I called my mom from the cell, and she told me, she said, that night when you called me, you sounded like you were about a three-year-old little girl. You were scared, and you were crying, and you weren't very legible, but you were scared. And I had been to jail two other times for simple battery, too. I never knew what the level was, but there was a certain, I couldn't ever get to that sweet spot anymore. You know, guys know, like, where it's like, everything's cool, and I'm having fun, and all that. It was like, it went right from that to, like, trouble. You know, there was that, I couldn't find that spot anymore. So I always got angry. And it talks about how it wielded a double-edged sword on us, and that was pretty much what happened to me. So I got angry every time I drank, and every time I drank, nothing bad happened every time I drank, but every time something bad happened, I was drinking. And I got out of jail that day, and my mom made me promise that I would get help. And I said, okay. So that day, I got out of jail. It was this was April the 15th, 2003, was when I went to jail. And I did what every good alcoholic did. I went home and I drank the rest of the bottle that was in the closet, you know, because it's pretty stressful being in the jail for 16 hours, which, you know, it wasn't that bad. I was hammered most of the time and hung over the rest of it. But so I drank the rest of that. And then on Friday, April the 17th, I picked up, they had phone books back then. You know, we don't really have phone books now, but 11 years ago, people used phone books. And I picked up the phone book, and it's real easy to find AA in the phone book. It's right there in the front. So I picked up the phone book, and I called this place called the Biscayne Room, which is over on Claremont. And this guy, I'll never forget it. He's no longer with us, but he was a great guy. His name was Frank, and he was super country and always wore overalls. And he said, it's Biscayne Room, how can I help you? And I said, well, I think I might need some help. And he told me about some meetings, and it just so happened that my lunch break at Lowe's was at 6 o'clock, and there was a meeting over there at 6 o'clock called the Rush Hour Group. And I went in over there the first day, and man, I was scared to death, and I was so angry, and I was so... I was just such a miserable person because, I mean, you want to get real miserable, stop drinking. You know, it's bad enough drinking, but then when you take your solution away, it's even worse. So I went in over there, and I sat down over there, and they had couches, and they had these big cozy chairs over there, and everybody there had been sober, like, forever. I mean, like, 10, 15, 20 years, you know, and a lot of those people that helped me are no longer here, but they were really tough. I'll tell you, there wasn't any coddling over there, and I am so grateful because it wouldn't have worked for me. I wouldn't have been able to get sober if people, oh, poor Sandy, you know. And I see a lot of that in AA. And yes, we are supposed to be compassionate, but, you know, if you want what we have, you do what we do. And we have a book that outlines it. And I'm a true believer in the program, in the book, in the fellowship, in the service, in the recovery. I mean, it all has to play together for me, you know. And that's how I sponsor. So I went over there, and I was there about 2 weeks, and I was crazy, absolutely insane. So I finally found a sponsor, and she was really tough. She worked at this place called MAR. And MAR is an intensive recovery program, and she was really tough on me. And I needed it, and I was so, so grateful. And at about 100 days in, I was irritable, restless, and discontent. I was absolutely insane. I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. I shouldn't have even been driving a car. I mean, I was just, I would get places and I wouldn't even know how I got there. I wouldn't remember anything. I mean, I was really a mess. And so I decided that I would go to the doctor. And I am an alcoholic. But, you know, I don't say no to too many other things. But my ultimate goal has always been to get drunk, to get oblivious, to get to oblivion. But, you know, alcoholism was working on me, and I didn't know it. I was new. I'd never been to an AA meeting before. I was 38 years old. So I told the doctor I was in recovery, but I said, I'm absolutely nuts. I said, I can't eat. I can't sleep. You got to help me. And she said, well, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you a couple of Xanax. And this is my story. I know this is AA, but I mean, this is part of what happened to me, so I have to share it. But it's brief, because like I said, I like to get my drink on, you know. And they gave me 10. She gave me 10, and she said, now you take these as prescribed, you know. So of course I did not. And, you know, but before I went in to get it filled, I called my sponsor, and I said, they want to give me some Xanax and tell me to take the next 3 days off and rest and get some sleep. And she's like, well, you know, if you do that, you're going to drink. And I just thought she was an idiot. You know, I mean, my gosh, she had 5 years sober and I had 3 months, but she was an idiot, you know. So I said, well, you know, I disagree with you. And I proceeded to go in. And before I even got out the door, I had already taken two because I just wanted some relief. I didn't care where it came from. And for the next 3 days, I drank and I did those pills. No, I'm sorry. For the 3 days, I did not drink. And then on the third day, guess what happened? I was out of pills. And I was supposed to be at work that Monday afternoon. And so I went to work and I'm all pilled up. You know, I took 10 Xanax in the course of 3 days and I was a mess. So I show up to go to work, and when I left to go to my AA meeting, instead of turning onto Claremont, I turned to the liquor store, and I went and I drank. And we'll just say some pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization happened that night, and I had a party, a big fat party. Might have been me, might have been some other people, I'm not real sure, but I was blessed that I woke up the next day, and my place pretty much looked like about 50 people had been there. I was drinking red wine, and I remember going to the liquor store and buying the two big magnums of wine because I knew one wasn't going to be enough, you know. And I remember opening the second one, and then after that, I don't really remember anything. But when I woke up the next morning, my apartment was trashed. There was red wine all over the place. I don't know if I had gotten sick, but the whole bathroom was filled with red wine. I had broken things. I had turned things over. I had the smoke detectors. One of them was knocked off the wall. And the strangest thing that happened was underneath my bed was one red wine footprint, like underneath the middle of my bed. Not on my bed, but underneath on the carpet of my bed. I don't know how that got there. I mean, I don't know if I moved the bed. I don't know if I, like, had some sort of magical power and I shrunk small and walked around on one foot under my bed. I'm not really sure how that happened. But those apartments eventually got torn down, and I really wanted to go in there and get that little square, you know, and keep it as kind of a token. So I don't really know what happened with that, but it was really bizarre. So to this day, it still baffles me. But and as bad as it was, it took me about a week to be able to go back to AA and pick up my white chip. And so, like, about 4 days later, I call my sponsor, you know, and I'm like, I got drunk. And she's like, no, you know what, you know, and she's like, oh, I saw that coming. I told you not to do that. And I was like, okay. And also, while I was having my little party in my apartment, I did some bouncing around. And I had a carpet burn on the whole right side of my face. I mean, the whole right side of my face. Like, I probably fell and slid, I guess. I was bruised from head to toe. I mean, literally, I was sore for like a week. So I don't know what I was doing. I mean, and I'm not joking. I really have absolutely, you know, there's blackouts where you're up and you're walking around, and then there's blackouts where, you know, and nobody else could tell me because nobody else was there. So I come straggling into AA like a week later, which was August the 8th, 2003, and, you know, a couple of people laughed at me, you know, because these people were hard. They were like, oh, we all saw that coming, and it's so funny how, like, if you're new and people tell you things like, go to a meeting, you know, you're in a danger stage, or, you know, I see this, you can't hear it. You just can't. I mean, I wish that you could. If I would have taken all the great suggestions that everybody given me through my life, not only in sobriety, I probably would have avoided a lot of problems in my life. But so I came back and I went to the meeting, picked up my white chip, and I just knew everybody was going to be so ashamed of me. You know, I was just so ashamed of myself. I was just like, these people have stood beside me, and they've dealt with me, and they've loved me till I learned to love myself, you know, and I was like, just so disappointed. But when I came back, everybody welcomed me, and everybody was so happy to see me. And there was another guy who pulled me to the side after the meeting, and he said, I'd like to tell you a story. And I was like, oh, no, you know, I mean, I got it coming. And he said, this story's probably going to scare you, and I hope it does. He said, but there was this girl who used to come here, and one day, and he said, she looked kind of like you. She was a little younger, but she looked a lot like you. And one day she left the meeting. She'd been coming to meetings for a while, and we thought she was doing okay. I mean, and one day she left, and she didn't come back. And she went home, and she drank herself to death. And her family found her like 3 days later in her apartment. Her dog had to be quarantined. Her dog had been in there with her for 3 days. And it did scare me, you know, because just the thought of thinking that my parents would have to do something like that was really scary to me. So it did scare me. And it was a good kind of scare. It was the kind of like, okay, Sandy, do whatever you're told. And that was when Alcoholics Anonymous truly began to work for me. And my sponsor said, into action. So we immediately got together. We started working on the steps. I'm an overachiever. And I remember when she gave me my fourth step, and she said, you got a month to do this. Well, you know, I had it done in like 4 days. I mean, and I probably wasn't as fearless and honest and thorough as I could have been, but, you know, I wanted to get it done because I wanted to be through with these steps. And she did this funny thing. She kept putting me, you know, I was like, I got it done. I'm ready. She goes, well, I said a month. I'm like, yeah, but I got it. I got it done. I got it right here. It's done. Well, it was a lot of pages, but it's done. And I so wanted to get that out. And what I realized was that over the course of my life, I've always been in such a hurry about everything. And she wanted to learn how to slow me down, you know. Not that she didn't want me to work the steps in a timely manner, but she wanted me to sit with it for a while. So it was hilarious because I used to hide it. I lived alone at that time of my sobriety. I eventually got a roommate, but I was still living alone, and I would hide my fourth step. You know, I mean, I'd like take it and put it somewhere different. You know, I had it in my refrigerator, you know, and then I had it in my glove compartment. And then I had it in like an empty pizza box. I mean, I'm like, who's going to find it, you know? There's nobody here but you. But finally, we did it, and we did that fifth step. And I'll tell you, I got a lot of freedom. Now, was it as thorough as some of them have been later in my life? Absolutely not. But it did give me a lot of freedom. It, especially with all those resentments and all those fears. And I never thought I was afraid of anything because I'm Sandy. Don't you know who I am? And the truth is I'm afraid of, I'm not now, but at that time I was afraid of everything. There wasn't much I wasn't afraid of, you know? And that was hard for me. I mean, it was really difficult for me to take a look at all these things. I didn't like it much, but I did it. I did what I was told. I went through the steps. And the sponsor at that time, she was great, and she was having some personal problems, and so she had to let me go. And that was really, it didn't hurt my feelings because I knew that she was doing what she had to do for her. I was at least clear enough in the head, and I was about 9 months sober, so I had to get another sponsor. So I got this other sponsor, and by that time I'd worked up to the ninth step. You know, we had done six and seven, and you know, I was sitting there with that eight-step list, ready to do that ninth step list, man. So I had my list, you know, walking around with my list. I'm ready to make amends. I'm ready to tell everybody how sorry I am, you know. And my sponsor at the time was like, I'm ready. And she's like, oh no, I don't know you and you don't know me. We got to start all over at the beginning. And I was really, really mad about that. But in hindsight, it turned out to be the best thing that ever happened to me. I'm so grateful that she did that for me. And, you know, I have the little saying that I've had the Goldilocks sponsorship. My first sponsorship was really hard. She was really hard. My second one was really soft. And my second sponsor, I grew up Christian, and she was Jewish. And I just knew, well, it's never going to work. Yeah, I mean, how could it possibly work, you know? And ironically, my second sponsor taught me more about God than anybody in my life up until about a year ago when I really started doing some seeking and I found what works for me, which I'll talk about a little bit later. But so we went through the steps again, and I was even more thorough, and it was really beneficial. And I met her in a funny way. This is a funny story. There was a guy in AA, and I call him one of the crusty old-timers, and I mean that with all the love and affection in the world, but he was really rough. He was one of those ones that had no problem calling you out at any time. He had this crazy mustache, and he was really gruff, and I despised this guy. I mean, I did. I was like, what a creep he is, you know? So one day I'm sitting over at the Biscayne Room, and the Biscayne Room, if you've never been there, they have a bar there. There's actually a bar in the room. You know, and there's bar stools and everything. So I'm sitting in there one day whining because I don't have any way to pay my my rent. And he comes in, and he's like, what's wrong? I said, I don't have any money to pay my rent, and I don't know what I'm going to do, and I left my job at Lowe's. I mean, just pathetic, you know. And he said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll give you a job. And I'm like, really? He goes, I'm going to write you a check today, and you're going to go to work for me. I'm like, what? He said, yeah. He said, you're going to go to work for me today. You're going to make $8 an hour. You're not going to make any more money. You're going to do exactly what I tell you to do. And I said, well, I don't even have a car. I had bought a car, wrecked a car, bought a car from somebody in AA, wrecked it, bought another one from him, wrecked it. So I owed two people in AA money for cars, and I did pay that off. But so he said, I'll come pick you up. So, you know, being as tactful as I can, I assumed that he wanted something from me. So I go to work for him the first day, and we go down. He worked at Antiques. He sold Antiques, and we went down to set up, and we got home that night, and he brought me home, and we got to my house, and I was like, okay, well, I guess this is the dealio right here. You know, this is about to go down, you know. And I said, can I ask you a question? He said, sure. I said, do you want to sleep with me or something? And he laughed in my face. Because I was real cute back then, remind you. I was 30 pounds heavier. No, you know, I mean, I was just a mess. I mean, like, I thought I had something going on, but I had nothing going on, let me tell you. And he laughed in my face, and boy, was that humiliating. He said, obviously, you don't know who my fiancé is, who was the person who became my second sponsor. So God moves in mysterious ways, and it was just really, really, you know, such a blessing that they came into my life, and they helped me so, so much. That people, they got married while we were together, and then to put it briefly, because this part's so far in the past now, but I got in a really crappy relationship when I was about 5 or 6 years sober, and it put a wedge between my sponsor and I, because I couldn't hear what she was saying to me, you know? This was not a healthy person for me, but I couldn't hear it, and I put myself through a lot of undue suffering, and So it was time for me to get another sponsor. And it was also time for me to join another fellowship. And it was also time for me to get some outside help. So I joined Al-Anon, got a new sponsor, and got some outside help at about 8 years sober. And the third sponsor that I have now, I still have her. And she's awesome. And she's the just right one. You know, the too hard, too soft, the just right. And I've been able to sponsor her as well as she sponsored me. She's always wanted to have a baby. Bottom line is, she and I went through the steps again. We sat down, we went through the book, and I did some revisions on my fourth step about this bad relationship that I had been in, and then we became friends. And a few years ago, she's a single mom, and she adopted a baby, a little baby girl, and it was all she had ever wanted in her life, and I got to experience that joy with her, you know, and she's just been phenomenal for me. And the reason I share so much about sponsorship when I talk is because it's still just as important to me as it was in the beginning. I still talk to my sponsor at least twice a week. I talked to her this morning. She just means the world to me, and she has a sponsor, and her sponsor has a sponsor. And the other thing, the other fellowship that we belong to, we all have the same sponsor. Myself, my sponsor, and my grand sponsor all have the same Al-Anon sponsor. So that was kind of an interesting thing, but she sponsored me first. And then, you know, my sponsor wanted to go through the Al-Anon steps, and I suggested that she use my Al-Anon sponsor. And once again, this is part of my story, and Al-Anon is a beautiful program, and it saved my life all over again. And my Al-Anon sponsor says that you can't scratch an alcoholic too deep without finding an untreated Al-Anon underneath there. So I was really grateful for that. So my recovery has been, you know, up and down, and I've made some huge mistakes. I believe in the program. I believe in the steps. So what happens for me now? You know, I'm 11 plus years sober, and in the last few years, some really great things have happened to me. I now live in a house. I'd lived in an apartment since I left school, you know, high school. I live in a house. I'm engaged to be married. Somebody actually likes me enough to keep me around. And I'll tell you a little bit about him, and he'll giggle over there, but he's one of those normal guys. You know about the normal drinkers? And let me tell you what he does. We live together, and just about every night he has a drink, because normal people can have a drink every night. And he pours about this much into the glass, this much, not even like an airport bottle, okay? And then before we go to bed, he leaves about this much in it for the spirits. I mean, what does that mean? What are the spirits, you know? And I'm like, well, why don't you just drink that thing, you know? And it's not that I want to drink it. It's just that I don't understand why you would only drink one drink. And he tells me because that's all he wants and that's all he needs. And I don't get that because I'm an alcoholic, you know? I mean, for me, that would never be enough, you know? I mean, never, never, never. So those kind of things, though I don't want to drink, certain little things trigger me and baffle me. Like, they have these flavored whipped marshmallow, blueberry whipped flavored vodkas and things like that now, and I don't get that. I don't understand it, you know. I wonder, you know, and the truth is, and my joke is, you know, any alcohol, A, I know what vodka tastes like, but I know what blueberries taste like, I know what whipped cream tastes like, but any alcohol to me tastes like a bologna sandwich and handcuffs, and that's just the way my mind automatically goes to that, you know, because the last time I drank, that's what I got. I got a bologna sandwich, and, you know, I was taken to the bologna sandwich in handcuffs. With a highly speeding police car. I know that cop is like so ready to get me out of the car, you guys. I mean, I don't know what I was doing back there, but I mean, I felt like we got there in a hot minute. So, to be a fly on the wall. The other cool thing that I've done in my sobriety, for one, is I've never stopped sponsoring. And it talks about this is a design for living when things get tough. And that's saved me so many times when I've been in those valleys that come in life. I sponsor. I never stop sponsoring. I usually try to sponsor two girls at a time. Now, I have more than two, but I usually try to have two in the book at all times. I go to one meeting definitely a week. This is actually my third meeting this week, and I actually went to one today, too, and did a fifth step with somebody. So I stay active in AA because I have to, because I need it, because it's just like, I don't know, it's like cool, and I enjoy it, you know? It's fun. I mean, and I remember when I first got sober, and I used to look around and go, you got to be kidding me. You guys are going to help me. I'm going to get better sitting in these rooms and listening to all this, and this is going to help me. And I'm going to find somebody that's going to show me how to get better. Absolutely. I did not believe it at the time, and I totally believe it now. And, you know, you never know where you're going to get the message, because, like I said, a person that I did not like at all in my home group at the time turned out to be the person that was one of the most beneficial people in my life. The other thing that is pretty cool is that I have made a lot of amends. I still have a few left to do, but the biggest amends that I've made, for one of the amends to myself, that I've forgiven myself, that I've learned how to love myself. Not all the time, and sometimes I still choose to make myself miserable, and I think that's a human trait, not necessarily an alcoholic trait, but there's been a lot of healing with my family, a lot of healing with my mother, a lot of healing with my father, a lot of healing with his wife, and it's been amazing. You know, I mean, my mom says things to me. I did this thing about 2 weeks ago. They do these things on Facebook called Throwback Thursday, where you put like an old picture of yourself and then, whatever. So I put this picture of me. It was probably 5 or 6, maybe even 7 or 8 years before I quit drinking. And, you know, once again, big, bloated, fat, puffy, ugly, unattractive, you know, just, yeah. And then I put a picture of me now outside hiking in the woods, smiling with a big face with a big waterfall behind me, you know, and I'm like, look at the difference here, you know. And my mom is on Facebook also, and she said something really sweet. She said, I'm trying to think of how she said it. She said, I'm so proud of you. And my daughter was missing for a long time, and I sure did miss her, and I'm glad I have her now, you know? And that's the gravy right there. That's the good stuff. And one more story that's awesome about my parents, and then I'm going to try to wrap it up here. When I was about 5 years sober, there was this bracelet that my grandmother had left me when she passed away, and it was a charm bracelet. And it had her birthday, and it was gold, and all the charms on it were gold. And my grandmother passed away in 1986. Well, I never got that bracelet. And I knew why I never got that bracelet. So I was about 5 years sober, and I was visiting my dad. He lives in Alabama. And it was just he and I in the room. I'll probably get emotional when I tell the story because it's so awesome. It was just he and I in the room, and he came in, and he handed me this box, you know, and in the box was the bracelet. And it was such a, not a lot was said, because it was pretty emotional, but my dad knew I was okay. He didn't have to worry about me anymore. He knew I wasn't going to take that to the pawn shop and pawn it, you know. And I still have that bracelet. Sometimes I wear it when I tell my story, but It just means so much to me. And all it was saying was, I know you're okay. And I'm not a parent, but I believe that our parents, all they want from us is, especially at my age, I'm 50, all they really want is to know that we're okay. You know, to know that we're okay and to have time with us. That's really all they want. They don't want another mug that says world's best dad or world's best mom or whatever. You know, they just want our time. But that was a super healing moment for me. And I've had many of those moments, you know, that just like, wow, you know. I mean, it's cool, and I know I've changed, but it's really cool when somebody gives you that validation. And it's an awesome feeling. And as far as what's going on with me, I would say probably the last year is all my life I've been searching for the religious place to be, you know. And it's been a difficult struggle for me. It's been really, really a struggle, because I grew up Baptist, and I tried to go back into that church when I got sober, and it just didn't work for me, you know. So I've been searching and searching and searching and searching, and this is how God leads you if you let him. This is how God leads you. So about 2 years ago, I started sponsoring this lady. She's the same age as my mom, and she has been so much of a blessing to me. I mean, like, she has given me so much more than I've given her, and she's 2 years sober, you know, but she has this life experience, you know. So she kept inviting me to go to this church, and I was balking, you know, because I was scared. I guess I was scared, the truth is. And so I finally went, and I was like, hey, this is pretty good. And it was a different denomination than I'd ever been to. And I was like, wow. So 2 weeks later, I invited my fiance to go, and we went, and something happened to us both that day. And thanks to sponsoring this woman, and thanks to being open-minded enough to doing something different, who knew, but I'm a Methodist. You know, I didn't expect that. And, you know, I joined the church and I got baptized, which was the thing that I've had on my list of things to do since I got sober, you know. So that's really cool. And I know that's religious, but, you know, we find what works for us. And it took me a long time to find it, you know. I mean, 50 freaking years in the making, for gosh sakes, you know. I was like, when am I ever going to find where I belong? And through all that, you know, I've just kept putting one foot in front of the other, and I've had troubles. I've had hurt. I've had difficulties. There was a time in my sobriety that I didn't want to live anymore. I didn't want to drink, but I didn't want to live anymore. And thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous, and specifically the 930 study group at the NABA Clubhouse, those people pulled me through. They pulled me through, because when you haven't been through something in sobriety, you don't really know how to handle it. You don't know how to handle the emotions and the feelings that are behind it. I didn't know how to get in or out of a relationship successfully. My way of getting in relationships was, hey, you go to a bar, you drink to oblivion, you find whoever it is that you want on the other side, and then you meet them, and then you guys shack up for 3.5 years, and then you blow that sky high, and then you move them out, or, you know, whatever happens, kick them out, and then you go to the bar, and then so on and so on. And that's what I've done my whole life. So, you know, I didn't know how to do it. And what I did was I trusted my sponsor, and she said, stay single, find yourself, work on yourself, get to know what you like and what you don't like. She called it group dating, which was like, say, after the meeting, let's all go have coffee. You know, not just me and you, but me and you and you and you and you. And we'd go bowling, and I just, like, all this world opened up for me. And I did find the things that I liked, you know. And I stayed single for 3 years, and I worked on myself so that when someone actually healthy came into my life, I was able to accept that, you know, rather than he used to call me a flight risk at the beginning of our relationship. And I was, you know, because I was scared. I was scared. But I can tell you that sobriety is the best thing I've ever done for myself. I don't ever want to have to go back to the way I was. I've made a host of friends. I've seen a fellowship grow up around me. I finally found the God of my understanding after so much searching, you know. And it's not that difficult. You just have to be willing, open-minded, and honest. And it's just been so phenomenal for me. And I just can't think. I mean, I just get overwhelmed sometimes at the things that have been given to me as a result of just doing the next right thing in front of me, and the benefits of being sober. Just, I mean, like, even the most awesome party day, you know, back before it was problematic, this is still better, you know. And I had a lot of good times drinking before, you know, before the snake came out and never went back in, you know. I mean, I used to have a really good time, and then it was like it was never fun. So I'm just really, really grateful, and who would have thought that Alcoholics Anonymous could have done all this? I certainly wouldn't have myself, but I am living proof that it works. It works really good, and I am going to continue to be a good standing member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm really thankful for being here, and thanks a lot for letting me share. I appreciate it.